When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Pablo, also known as Poppy, from Global Penguin Society.
Hello, Neil. So pleased to be with you. And I'm really thrilled to be able to share everything we do to help penguins worldwide.
Poppy, I'm so excited to talk to you today and educate our listeners on everything that's going on with penguins globally. Now, Poppy, tell us a bit about yourself. How did you first become interested in penguin conservation? And what brought about your work with Global Penguin Society?
So I live in Patagonia, in the southern part of Argentina. And I always say that I work on penguin conservation and research thanks to my grandmother. You know, my grandfather was Greek. That's why the complicated surname. And he came to Patagonia in 1921. Over 100 years ago. And my grandmother, back then, she used to visit penguin colonies along the coast. And when I was a very small boy, she used to tell me the stories about her visits to see the penguins. And I would imagine her like going with horses or wagons in very wild Patagonian coast. And when she was telling me those stories, she was kind of connecting me to nature through the penguin. I remember she was telling me like how penguins would go into the ocean and come back to feed the chicks, or how they would protect the chicks from predators. And I was 2-3 years old, and that was so special to me. And that's one of the things that made me dedicate also a lot of efforts in terms of education, you know, to connect more kids to nature through penguins. But then when I was an adolescent and I visited like a huge penguin colony, there was like this special moment that I'm not able to describe what happened there, but it was like a very strong connection, you know? And I felt that they were so vulnerable and that I needed to help them, that they were like the mission of my life somehow. In those years, I'm talking about the 80s, 40,000 penguins were dying here in this province in Argentina due to oil spill. So it was very normal to go to the beach. You would see penguins dying or dead oil on the beach, hundreds of them. People naturalized that and politicians ignored that. So I set up a rehabilitation center after one of the big events, and that helped to attract the attention of the media. But then after watching lots of penguins, I thought, have to be more efficient and have to be more helpful. And then I started an academic career, like as a researcher, like a scientist. And I was working like that for 10, 12 years. And then I realized that, of course, science is very important, but it was not sufficient. It was not enough to create conservation change. So I created the Global Penguin Society, which is an international organization that promotes the protection of the 19 species of penguins that exist on our planet right now. And we work through research. We conduct research to identify what are the problems that penguins are facing, but also the solutions. So with that science, we justify conservation action. So, for example, we realize if that there is a need, for example, to increase the availability of food for the penguins. So So we go and talk to the governments to create protected areas, to make food available for penguins, to reduce the risk that penguins are facing. And of course,
wow.
This huge education program.
Poppy, this sounds like such a beautiful full circle story from what you've mentioned, that you were growing up with these stories of interconnectedness with wildlife and the penguins through your grandmother, to now actively playing a role in the species conservation and advocating for them as well. And it sounds like not only them, but you're wanting to make these policy changes, which I'm super excited about getting into as well. Can you talk us through exactly what is going on with penguins globally, so our listeners can get a real idea of the plight of the problem?
Sure, Neil, sure. So right now there are 19 species of penguins that recognize officially, and half of them are considered threatened. They are listed as threatened in the red list of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And this is because penguins have specific characteristics that makes them more vulnerable to some of the current threats of the oceans and land. Basically, they're affected by fisheries, oil pollution, and plastic pollution now. When they come on land, penguins are affected by human disturbance and also the introduction of new predators. For millions of years, penguins evolved in places where there were no predators, so they didn't need to fly to escape. But now humans, we introduce these new species that are a threat for penguins that do not know how to defend themselves. But on top of these marine and coastal threats, there is an issue with climate change as well. So it depends on the region, depends on the species, you have a different situation. Penguins only live in the southern hemisphere. This is interesting to mention. Penguins appeared for the first time on our planet in New Zealand over 16 million years ago. And from there, they conquer all the southern hemisphere. They conquer South America. Back then, Antarctica and South America were connected. So penguins were coming to South America, new species appear, I'm talking about millions of years, and then came back to New Zealand, they mixed, new species appear, and at some point, Antarctica split from South America. So the penguins conquered the Atlantic Ocean, and then they could reach Africa, and then the Indian Ocean, and then Antarctica. So I always, sometimes in my talks, I make a joke, I say, I'm sorry, penguins are not from Antarctica, because people perceive that they are from Antarctica,
Yeah, that's like the big image that they see all the time of like the big colonies in Antarctica. So that's just a general assumption. But no, they're sparsely located throughout all of the southern hemisphere. You are right. So that's super exciting to challenge that belief that they're only found in Antarctica.
Yeah, right. And this is because of the Hollywood movies and cartoons, that most of them were made in Antarctica because of the landscape, because the Emperor Penguin is spectacular, the largest and the most famous one. But I would say that out of the 19, only 4 or 5 are more linked to Antarctic environment. The rest of them, we even have a tropical penguin in Galapagos, close to the equator. We have penguins in the deserts of Chile, Namibia, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. So most of the penguins, they don't like the ice.
You probably just shocked a lot of people saying the term tropical and penguin.
It's like a contradiction, right?
Well, not to those that know, right? So this is like a great opportunity for people to start learning more about the penguin species, which I'm hoping they're going to do today. So the name Global Penguin Society. Okay, so how does the name come about, and how have you integrated that into this Southern Hemisphere worldwide approach? How can you summarize what your exact mission is, and what method are you going about to get it done to someone that's hearing about you guys for the first time right now?
Right. So this is an interesting question because it's connected to why we decided to create this. So
yes, tell us.
Yeah, because during the time I was mostly a researcher, we had a penguin International Penguin Congress every 3 years. And I could see that it was like a scientific description of how bad penguins were going. It's like describing perfectly well that your house is in fire, but not stopping the fire, you know? So then I said, we need to create some sort of network and institution that where we can capitalize on all the fantastic researchers and research that is available there to push conservation forward. And that was the idea of creating institution. And then to make it easy to remember, we created it. We gave it that name, GPS, Global Penguin Society. So yeah, we work as a network. Our projects, they change, depends on the urgency or depends on the strategy. We have a lot of action in New Zealand, in Chile, we have in Argentina, some action with colleagues in South Africa as well. And Antarctica, it changes all the time. Perfect. We also foster the creation of a group that is called the Penguin Specialist Group of IUCN, because we saw the need to create like a conservation arm where IUCN could have an influence. And that has been fantastic because it's another circle of
An amazing partner to have on board as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And we learn a lot. That's another network. The way we connect and we play in the sandbox with other colleagues, it's really enriching.
Yes, that is the best way conservation and science moves forward, through collaboration and understanding and different forms of learning. There could be methods that other scientists have used in different parts of the world, and you think, oh, actually, that's a really good idea. We can start applying that. So I'm all for that collaborative movement forward. So you mentioned prior to us just jumping into that little section there about these oil spills. What was exactly going on in Patagonia at that time? And obviously that led to the spark of GPS. And how has everything evolved with GPS since then?
So the problem here was similar to what was happening in South Africa. We have very frequent and unreported spills and small spills. So there were lots of spills in the ocean, and penguins, the problem is that they swim hundreds and thousands of kilometers in the ocean, most of the time on the surface. So if there is an oil and they cross it, they get oil
floating.
And then,
yeah,
exactly. Two things happen. They lose the floating ability, so they sink. But if they're strong enough, because penguins are very hardy, they manage, some of them, sometimes 20, 50% of the penguins that get oil, they manage to get on land, but then they die from starvation. Because once they are oiled, they don't have the waterproof condition in the feathers. The cold water touches the skin, so they cannot go back to the ocean to eat, and they starve to death. And that's really sad. It's really awful. But this is one of the reasons we also say that penguins are excellent indicators of the health of the oceans. Because you see penguins, but there's a lot going on with the oil affecting the chemistry of the ocean, many other species that we don't see even in the bottom of the ocean. So penguins are, you know, alarming, saying, oh, there's an oil spill there. And that was the situation there. It was a similar situation in South Africa. In South Africa, it was worse because there was all the oil coming from Asia to go to the States or Europe were coming through South Africa. So there were a lot of accidents, shipwrecks. We didn't have that in Argentina, but we have this uncontrolled situation with hundreds and thousands of penguins dying. So yeah, so
imagine what a sight that must have been to come across a beach and just see thousands and thousands of dead penguins. It must be horrific, because you're also thinking, what is all this soot, they're covered in all this oil, and then you've got the visceral shock of seeing dead animals in hundreds in front of you. You know, it's a lot to process. So I kind of want to know a bit about your internal drive there to be like, no, I need to do something about this. What was that spark like for you?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because it's something that's still with me now. It's like this. Some situations, it's up to you to do something and create a change. So
yes.
I was there. I was shocked. I said, I have to do something. I cannot leave these penguins dying. So I started collecting them. I set up a little rehabilitation center when I started. And then the first time, I released one of these penguins back in the wild after rehabilitating. I saw that. I said, wow, wait, if I can make this little change and somehow let this penguin live and reproduce and produce more penguins for the population, I couldn't do much more. So that was the clicking point. And I said, and then I started growing and growing and making things bigger. But that sense of it's up to you, it's still with us now. I mean, we see a lot of situations that if we decide to shut up or don't or do anything or look in the other side, nothing will change.
That is so good.
So that's important.
Yeah, that foundational building block is still in you. And I think you need it in this industry. You need that drive, you need that fire. And on that note, we're going to take our first break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back soon.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Poppy from Global Penguin Society. We have just been touching base on the creation of Global Penguin Society GPS and the incredible story of Poppy, who had such fire and drive to form the GPS after seeing thousands and thousands of penguins that were affected by oil spills in is it Patagonia? Was that correct, Poppy? Was it that area?
Exactly.
Yes. And it was this interconnectedness of his story from his grandmother telling him about the stories of nature and how she connected with the penguins and how that led to his drive into nature. And then now saving penguins globally. And I'm super excited to figure out with you, Poppy, how is climate change affecting penguins across the Southern Hemisphere? And how is GPS using this information to address environmental impacts on these species, these 18 species of penguins?
So climate change, since we have penguins living in different environments, climate change is impacting them in different ways. In Antarctica, climate change is disrupting, is changing the pattern of ice formation and melting, the timing also of ice formation and melting. And that affects the habitat that penguins need to eat, but also to feed, because the food depends also on the ice. But outside of Antarctica, climate change is changing the distribution of food and the availability of food for penguins. If you are a penguin, Neil, you would be in your nest, you will have your chicks, but then at some point when the chicks are small, you need the food to be close to the colony because you cannot fly.
I feel like I would do really bad as a penguin. I would have been one of those penguins that got hit by the oil and they would have just been like, no, it's over for me now. I can't do it.
But you look like a great swimmer, so you would do okay. So imagine, you need the food to be close to the colony because you cannot invest a lot of time because you have to come back to feed them. Climate change is moving away the food from the colony. So it takes you longer to get the food. You will invest more energy and then you would be more exhausted. And then you will end up feeding your chicks less. That is creating some declines in some populations, you know?
Yes.
And also, and that is in the ocean. But outside, when penguins come on land, climate change is increasing the frequency and the intensity of heat waves. So sometimes we saw case moments in which the temperature is lethal for penguins. So they reach like the lethal temperatures and penguins die when they are trying to go from the nest to the ocean to refresh themselves. And also climate change is linked to wildfires. And for some reason, we just don't know, many colleagues are trying to explore this, penguins don't seem to recognize the fire as a threat. So they don't run away like other animals. They don't escape. So that's something that we're also working to include contingency plans for fires in management plans. And one of the things answering your question, that we recognize is that we cannot address climate change in the short term. We cannot solve it right now. But what we can do is reduce the impact of human activities so we give penguins more ability to cope with climate change. So somehow we make them more resilient. And humans, we have a lot to do with the resilience of penguins and all the wild. So if we manage our activities like fisheries, oil, human disturbance, others better, then penguins don't have so much pressure on them and they are more able to cope with climate change.
And on these issues like oil spills, overfishing, plastic pollution, how is GPS tackling these issues? How is it getting involved in ensuring that these aren't going to be problems that are still prevalent in 5 to 10 years' time, in 15 years' time?
Exactly. So we, depending on the case or on the threat, we design strategies. And depending also on the country, because each country has a different way of perceiving the animals. For example, in New Zealand, penguins are sacred to the Maori communities. In some other places, they take them for granted. So we analyze the situation.
But I would love to just pause on that for 1 second, because I want to jump into this as you've said that. With this global perception of penguins, we touched base on it a bit earlier, talking about this idea of just seeing penguins in Antarctica. But you just mentioned there the traditional view from New Zealand with penguins is very different. Now, this is also culturally based. How does media and culture feed into this global narrative around penguins specifically? Obviously, in the noughties, we had films like Happy Feet, which then are driving towards the youth and then their perception of penguins. But then you have documentaries, for example, by David Attenborough, who's showing all of these visual images of penguins in a more an adult context and documentary style context. How do all these media and cultural movements shape the way that globally we view penguins?
I think it's fantastic. So I think what we need to do, I think, is to develop all sorts of languages to reach all kinds of audiences. So whatever is useful, we need to use it if we are working for conservation, because in the end, we try to foster a conservation culture, and culture changes. So we need to use different media, different strategies, different ways. It could be a newspaper, it could be, as you said, a documentary film. Some people think documentary films are boring, so maybe like a Disney, more entertaining, but reach the emotions of people, call their attentions, and then we are able to deliver a message. I love also, and we learned that as a scientist, I could be speaking and sharing really fantastic facts, but that will reach the mind. It won't reach the soul of the people. Uh-huh. So it will never be able to make them change their behavior. So
I think everyone needs to find that sort of trigger connection for them. You know, sometimes it's hard to view something separate from yourself and say, oh, like, how does that matter to me? But it should matter. And we need to find a way to make it matter 100%.
Yeah. And we need to discover as conservationists, what is the password for that community? Because in every single conservation... Every single challenge that we have, whether if it's creating a protected area or implementing a management plan, we need to have the support of the community. So we work a lot with the media and in the elaboration of what is the key message for that community, so they support this conservation action. But then, so if we work in New Zealand, we also, of course, need to use this cultural aspect of there are myths and legends about penguins. The Maoris, they used to think that penguins were gods. And during a big storm, the lightning bolts fell on this god and created the crests. So they think that the crests are lightning bolts during the storm when the gods were coming on land. So all that thing creates a fantastic dimension that is really helpful for conservation. And then we also change, you know, like we also pay attention to what's happening in other countries. Like in the United States, it looks like people are more fond on mammals in general, you know? There's a Marine Mammal Protection Act, but I don't think there is a Seabird Protection Act. So that means that as a country, and the same thing, the opposite thing happens in the England, on the United Kingdom. They're more fond on birds. All the bird watcher groups, they come from England, you know? So this cultural thing It's interesting. And then you see how that influence, and different countries have different perceptions of the groups of animals.
So how does this tie into when it comes to GPS tackling the issues like oil spills, overfishing, plastic pollution, and wider problems within those sectors that are affecting seabird population?
Yeah, so for example, one of the key things that we do is we try to implement things that will stay on land, will stay on this planet after we leave. And one amazing thing that we've been investing a lot of effort is creating marine protected areas. So we have been able to help protect 32 million acres of penguin habitat in the ocean and on land. And that has been through working with governments, with other NGOs, with partners, and that is also on land and on in the ocean, right? Or marine corridor, for example. And through that, we have been able to at least benefit 2.5 million penguins worldwide. So that's a way we contribute with climate change as well, because in those protected areas, all the activities are better managed. And as I described before, that reduces the pressure on penguins. We also work a lot to pass legislation. You would be amazed to see how, I mean, the lack of legislation to protect the wildlife, even in countries where people care about wildlife, like here in Argentina, but the legislation is 100 years old, so primitive and basic. So we are also investing a lot in that thing, because in the end, we can complain here, there, the social media, but it's up to the law to punish 100%. And to also avoid harms.
And it sort of sits on the back burner for most governments, you know, environmental policy, animal conservation policy. It definitely only really, I found, gets pushed through when you have organizations like yourself that are doing the driving, that are really presenting these figures and wanting to see these changes happen. It's very rare that it reverses from the inside out from Parliament to be like, oh, actually, the Parliament have come in to make this change. No, this always been mostly instigated by outside NGOs and organizations. Which is a good thing, but it brings us back to the original point. If the groups weren't around, the compound issues would continue being affected. It would cause a cascade of issues. The policy changes won't happen. The problems will continue. This is why organizations like yourself are so important. Now, when it comes to GPS, I've seen that you guys are using like satellite tracking and community-based conservation programs. Can you explain what these approaches are and how it helps you protect the penguin populations in these multiple countries?
Yeah, that is amazing, you know, because part of our research project is to track penguins in the ocean. Technology is amazing because for a long time, for decades, I've been working with penguins for 36 years. And at the beginning,
incredible.
We didn't have the technology.
The amount of impact that you have had in those 36 years is just insane.
Thank you. So, but at the beginning, Neil, we didn't have the technology we have now. So we were trying to improve help penguins with the information we had. But then the technology allowed us to know where are the penguins when we don't see them? How are they, where are they migrating to? So then when you know, you can overlap where they are with the, again, harmful human activities, and then propose protected areas, management plans, improve those activities. But then we have this amazing information about penguins, you know, swimming thousands of kilometers in the ocean. And then we said, this is amazing. We are getting this information, but we need to share this with the public. So we created this campaign, which is the trip of the penguin, is the migration trip. And we track penguins right now at this moment. We have 25 Magellanic penguins migrating from Patagonia, crossing Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil. It's about like a 5,000-mile migration trip. And everybody can go to our website, globalpenguinsociety.org. And for free, no cookies, no apps, no needs for anything, you can track the penguin in real time. Penguin emits a signal to a French satellite and goes straight to our platform. And people can see the image of the real penguin, how many kilometers or miles they swam, the average speed. Yeah. And then the other things that we added is like, we named these penguins after celebrities. So you can track Taylor Swift, Leonardo DiCaprio, Roger Federer, Jane Goodall, Bertie Gregory, many others. And that has been a fantastic tool, education tool, an awareness tool to, of course, to engage people because they go to our website, they learn more. But apart from that, Neil, I see that people realize that it's difficult to be a penguin. It's not fun all the time. It's not happy penguin all the way. So they make these efforts. They swim a lot. And then we need to do something to make their lives easier, you know, when they are in the ocean, when they are on land. And there are so many ways we can do that.
Wow. I really want to jump back into that, the celebrity names of the penguins. And I will do that a bit later. But what I've just picked up there is you guys are combining this integration of ocean conservation, science, the management, and education. What have all of these insights and these interdisciplinary approaches, what have they revealed about interactions between penguins, people, and their ecosystems?
So the species, penguin species are different. You know, there are some penguins get, for example, habituated with people easier, and some others are very shy. But the good thing is, like most of the penguin species, if the colonies are open for visitors, and if the colony is well managed and implemented, you can offer an enriching touristic experience through ecotourism, but at the same time reduce the impact on penguins and humans and the environment. Because in some colonies you go, penguins are sleeping, they don't even wake up, they don't even care that you're there. And that's because the colony was well managed. So that's a way in which you can connect people with nature. People see the value of protecting this environment and this species. And that generates a lot of incomes for developing countries. Most penguins occur also in developing countries. And there are 296 colonies on the planet, penguin colonies, that are open for visitors. And that generates a lot of money for the communities. So conservation in this sense is not all only like about protecting the environment. It's a source of incomes. It's a way to secure these livelihoods for people. So in many cases, we need to talk the language of economy. You know, when we meet politicians, when we go to congresses, and also talking to businessmen. Okay, we say conservation is not a waste of money. You can learn a lot because a healthy colony, a healthy environment is more productive. And through ecotourism, you can, when you protect these penguins, they generate money. So when we make this link in their minds, people support more.
When it comes to penguin-specific ecotourism and the overarching ecotourism landscape, you've mentioned, yes, it is an economic driver. But how do you as GPS ensure that it benefits both the wildlife and local economies? You mentioned just beforehand, if it's a well-managed colony, that's good. But where are all of these external poor managements coming in? How do we make sure that they're going to the right places, that they're functioning correctly, and that the money is going to the right places? How does all this happen? And is this something that you guys are involved in as well?
Yeah, so we work a lot to do management plans. A management plan is a document that says, okay, this colony should be managed in this way. So if it's a small colony, you put like a capacity, you define the maximum capacity of people that can be in the tourist trail at a certain time. So the impact is reduced. And also we make sure that these rules are well implemented. So we make a follow-up all the time. We work a lot with governments, but also with landowners, because like in Patagonia or in New Zealand, there are a lot of ranches and penguins settle down in the ranch, in the private ranch. So, and it's been amazing and very productive to work with private landowners. First of all, because it's easier to implement things. I mean, if you're talking with a rational person that cares about this wildlife.
Okay. Which isn't always the case.
In most of the cases, I would say in all the cases except one case, then they see the benefits of protecting, then they see that it's a good business for them to do an ecotouristic operation. And in many cases, they get rid of the sheep. Most of these places were sheep ranchers. Then they don't care anymore about the sheep. Yes. And then they go for the penguins.
We're all about penguins now.
Exactly. Because, of course, if it's well managed and if they protect the environment and there's a conservation philosophy behind, not just like a fake operation, then everybody wins. And penguins are safe. They keep on coming more. People love that. They pay. One of the things that it came to my mind when you were asking is that, but that happens in every sense, not only penguins. Just like when we consume something, we need to be more informed consumers. You know, we need to know what are we buying. And we should be buying something that is more sustainable, not only in the way it was produced, but also how it will be discarded. But the same thing should apply to tourism. We should make some sort of intelligence, learn how is the place we are going to visit managed? Am I going to harm the place by visiting, or am I going to contribute to something? So I think we should have this kind of awareness before we decide to visit a place.
And to leave you on that thought, as we go on to our short break, we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Poppy from Global Penguin Society GPS. I hope you guys had a good think about the impact that you're making when you go to travel to these countries and want to interact with wildlife. Now, we just left off speaking about how sustainable tourism, ecotourism, conservation tourism can be done right to benefit both local economies and wildlife. Now, on that note of actually thinking about the impacts that we're having when we go to these areas, Poppy, what if there are any common myths or misunderstandings about penguins that still persist, or the conservation related to them? And how can we help listeners reshape their perception? So, for example, one of the things we've tackled already is the idea of just penguins just being in Antarctica, and people maybe just thinking, oh, I have to go into an Antarctic cruise to go and see them. But in reality, they're all over the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, exactly. So some things are connected to a conservation impact. Some others don't. Here and there, they say, oh, penguins, some penguins can fly. No, penguins do not fly. No, they don't fly. They used to have an ancestor 60 million years ago that it was a flying bird. Not anymore. Then there is this kind of myth in which the penguin, the male conquers the female with a stone. That's not like that. But what is true is that they are quite loyal to the partners. Because, you know, the only way, if you're a penguin again, the only way to raise your chicks alive is to have a stable partner. Because you have to protect the eggs and the chicks for 5 or 6 months. So when you are in the nest, your partner will be in the ocean. And when she comes back, you can go. And the only way to synchronize that is if you have a stable couple.
So you have to be locked in with your partner.
Exactly. So within a season, you can do that. But we also have divorces. And most of the divorces, the reason is that when they don't get to raise their chicks alive, you know? So they decide to mate with somebody else. But if things go okay, we know of a couple, penguin couple, that they stayed together breeding for 17 years, at least 17 years. So, by the way, these penguins that we have here, they can live up to 35, which is a lot. But coming back to the
loyalty. So half their lives.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing is, like, this is something that connected to the migration that we described before. One of the questions we wanted to answer is, okay, they are together within the breeding season. What happens when they go in the ocean and they are 5 months in the ocean? Are they swimming together? No, they don't swim together. So we put devices on couples. We have Messi, the soccer player, and his wife and many others. And we saw that they go different ways, but they have a meeting point, because when the breeding season starts and they come back, they go back to the same nest in 90% of the cases. So that's another reason why we should protect the habitat so much. And we cannot destroy the nest or the colonies, even if penguins are not there because they are migrating. So that's interesting in this species, because it's not like they build a new nest every year. They don't care. No, they defend that territory for their lives. They invest a lot fighting with others to keep that territory. The territory attracts the females. The territory allows them to protect the chicks better. And it's, the passport to have chicks that are safe and alive. So protecting the habitat is key for all the animals, but particularly for penguins in this case.
Yes. Now, even as you were speaking there, you mentioned some names from your what you've mentioned beforehand as well, the Celebrities in the Ocean campaign. So you've named these penguins after people like Messi and I think Taylor Swift, for example. Now, this has captured global attention for conservation. Can you talk us through a bit about what this campaign was and how it helped you?
So it was amazing because first it was an experiment. But we had it was a great hit, you know, because we have a lot of followers in social media, people commenting on that. We have soccer players like Kun Agüero, Sergio Agüero. He was a goal scorer in Manchester United, and he's even sharing in his social media, my penguin is doing this and that. And we made sure that Taylor Swift, she knows about her penguin. Leonardo DiCaprio knows about her penguins. And many others. We have Anya Taylor-Joy. We have celebrities that are more local to Argentina, but Messi is international. But people responded, and the fan clubs, you know, the followers, the people that love the Swifties, for example, they were crazy about following Taylor. And then we also like when we describe, like we like to link the behavior of the idol, of the celebrity, with what the penguin is doing, you know? And that's really funny, really funny.
Taylor Swift's on tour again. That's what she's out swimming in the ocean. Oh, wow. So we've talked about this now, what is a technically an online campaign, but you guys have education programs where you've reached thousands of students and you've taken about, 13,000 children to colony visits. How have these experiences changed young people's attitudes towards conservation?
It's fantastic, Neil. And I think it's one of my favorite activities, going, taking those kids and introducing the kids to the penguins, you know, because
you kind of feel like how your grandma must have felt when she was telling you about penguins all those years ago? Yes.
Exactly, because it's like telling thousands of kids the story of my grandmother. The problem is, the issue is that we realize that most of the communities that live close to penguins, they don't have information or they don't have access to this. And some colonies are half an hour drive away from those communities. So we take them, we pay everything, the tour guide, the bus, the food, the entrances, everything.
That's so good, because accessibility is a big issue. You know, we've spoken about sustainable tourism already, but these are people coming from across the globe to access these colonies. But often or not, a lot of times with the organizations I've spoken to, sometimes communities can't access their own wildlife. And that's amazing. Absolutely. That you've been able to do that.
Thank you. Yeah, you're so right. And then the thing is that in these towns, these kids, they tend to stay there and become the decision makers and decide about the fate of nature. And
yes, you're planting the seeds already. You're like, yes, I'll get them when they're young so they know.
Exactly, exactly. And this program started like about 15 years ago or so in a little town here as an experiment. And in that town, one of the presidents of Argentina, Juan Perón, was raised. So we always say, we can have the next president in the group. You never know. You never know. It could be somebody that have a great influence in a businessman, a decision maker, whoever. And now, of course, some of the kids that we took, they are 25, 30 years old. So like, and they are there working. They are part of the system now. And this is something I always try to emphasize, that, and that's one of the things that give me optimism, you know, is the perception, the care about the environment of young generations. And those young generations are voting. And will become more, most of the planet will be, you know, will be composed by these people that have this environmental perception in their DNA, you know?
Yes.
And that can be very, very powerful.
I love that. That is incredible. And you sounds like you've done such a fantastic job there. And it's going to continue, you know, it's going to continue with them and it's going to continue with the organization. And the trickle effects that this will have,
huge,
huge. And that's fantastic. Now, Poppy, you've worked, you said 36 years, was that correct? 36 years in penguin conservation. Yeah. Out of that time, what has been an unexpected discovery about penguin behavior or ecology that has just surprised you the most? And you're like, oh, wow, like this is either going to change things or it changed your own perception of something. I'd love to know.
Yeah, so I will connect both questions, because one thing was when we were educating the local communities, but then we say we need to reach the global audiences. So through the partnerships with other partners like National Geographic or Disney and their products, we have been able to deliver a conservation message to millions of kids and people. Like right now, a couple of months ago in April, Disney Nature launched this documentary called Secrets of the Penguins. And it was already seen by 100 million people on the planet. We appear there, I appear there, I'm part of two of the three chapters. And then I go to the second part of your question. And what we filmed there, I was thrilled, and that was a big surprise, you know? And that's something not only in terms of research, but also in terms of hope and conservation. We could film penguin couples where each partner belonged to a completely different species. So we had a rockhopper penguin and a macaroni penguin. The macaroni is even like 30% larger. So you see two species that are breeding. When this happens in nature, the chances of the chicks of the eggs hatching and chicks surviving is very low because you have a hybrid, what we call a hybrid, a mixture of two species. But these penguins, we call them, it was rockaroni and rockhopper and macaroni. So the chicks, we call them rockaronis, like a mixture of the names. So the rockaroni chicks, they hatch, they survive, and we saw them breeding. So, and this is something that I even mentioned in the documentary film. When two species come together like this, they introduce new genes into the next generation. And that's so powerful because then you have a new, like a new penguin somehow that is able to combine the best of both species and thrive into the challenges that they will face. And that's how penguins have been doing for millions of years. In the end of the chapter, I say this because I was in the middle. I was thrilled, you know, to see that with my own eyes. And I said, we are literally witnessing penguin evolution before our eyes. And this is something I never thought I would be able to see. And now it's filmed, so everybody can see that on Disney Plus.
You're like, I saw it and it's on tape. Yeah, that's even better. It's one of those things you're like, no, I did it. I swear I did it. I saw it. And you're like, well, actually, it's on video now. So I've got proof. Poppy, now, if you could ask a wild penguin one question, what would it be?
I think I would love them to tell us how can we be more helpful. What do they need from us? What do they want me to do? Because sometimes you kind of, okay, this is helpful, this is not. What they would ask us to do. I think that would be fantastic, you know? And I think at some point, maybe with artificial intelligence, we'll get to talk to penguins one-on-one.
Who knows? You never know. It might come up in the future. They'll find an animal translator through artificial intelligence and we'll be able to have this communication. But I loved your answer because it was about what you can do for them. And it just shows how integrated this conservation is into your being. And it really shines through from our conversation today. And that it just really radiates. So it's been very, very enlightening to have this chat with you today, Poppy. We're nearing the end of our chats and I would love to speak to you for many more hours, but we have a show and we've got a schedule. But I would love to know what one takeaway you want our listeners to remember about the interconnectedness between penguin health, ocean ecosystems, and even human well-being.
So I think, of course, we work directly on penguins. Through penguins, we benefit the oceans. And by protecting the oceans, we protect the entire planet. Oceans provide food and oxygen and regulate the weather on the entire planet. So the weather we eat, thanks to the weather we survive. So by protecting penguins, we are making a global contribution. But something I'd like to say is that we each have a role. We don't necessarily need to be a biologist to do conservation. Conservation has multiple dimensions and phases. So we need journalists, we need engineers, we need architects, psychologists, we need people working in finances. So maybe we don't like to be biologists, we don't like to be researchers, but we have other skills. And with those skills and finding our own passion, we can be so helpful for conservation. And as I say, if I have to learn something about penguins in my career, is how brave they are. So I think we need to face the problems. We need to, you know, act against all odds and never give up, you know, to work
together. We need to learn from them.
a lot, you know, a lot. And that's, it's happening to us all the time. When I have to make a big decision, I need to go to a penguin colony because I see them that they don't care. They go through the fisheries and oil and whatever, but they get the food, come back, feed the chicks. That's the goal. And if they are so brave, being so little, how can we give up? And there's so much, we are so important. We have so much power. And people sometimes, they don't realize how powerful we are to decide and shape the future.
Exactly. And speaking of learning from the penguins, where can people learn more about GPS? If you can tell them about any websites or social media, and I'd love for you to just end on a final message of hope for penguin conservation worldwide.
Perfect. So if you want to reach us and learn about what we do, we have our website at globalpenguinsociety.org. But we are very active. We have fantastic social media in Instagram, Global Penguin Society, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or X now. So, and we post a lot of things about, you know, awards that we receive when we are in the field, when we meet special penguins, when we meet special people, and also when we take kids to visit the penguin colonies. So I think like a wrap up message is that don't stay just complaining about the situations. Use that energy to solve that energy, to solve that. We are so powerful, as I said before, and we need to use that power in something that can be greater than all of us. And think always about what can we leave to this planet behind us.
Wow, so beautifully said, Poppy. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to all of us today and enlighten us on your incredible journey with penguin conservation. And thank you all for listening to Our Altered World today. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, OurAlteredWorld.com, where you can learn, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.